أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين وشفيع المذنبين سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد والصلاة والسلام على أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المنتجبين لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب الأصل والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف ولعنة دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين ما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي For the hastening of the return of our 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, one salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. As we continue in commemorating the tragedies after Karbala, last night, for those who were with us, we mentioned that we wanted to begin a short discussion for the few nights that we are together from now until the day of Arba'een, looking at what happened post-Karbala, and to try to sort of step out of the box and be able to try to analyze some of the events which were happening before Karbala, why or what precipitated the need for Sayyid al-Shuhada to go forth towards his eventual martyrdom on the day of Ashura. And also, how do we better understand this event of Karbala, which obviously forms such a pivotal, has such a pivotal role in our lives, so much so that we dedicate at least 2.5 months as a community to grieve and mourn over the tragedy of Karbala. And last night, for those who are here, as we talked about the mission of Sayyid al-Shuhada and the fact that when he went forth, that he went with full knowledge and he let his companions know, and he let the family know what would happen to them. They weren't going into a dark abyss that they didn't know what the outcome would be. We mentioned, by quoting some of the statements of Sayyid al-Shuhada, that he was very well aware of what would happen on the day of Ashura. He was very, very well aware that the outcome would be that they would not be returning back to Medina after this journey. And so obviously, he prepared himself, he prepared the family, the companions, for their eventual martyrdom. We want to build upon that tonight and look a bit about who Hussein is, alayhi salam, and also just some aspects of why we have these mourning programs. Why do we commemorate, and where do we get this inspiration from? You know, all these things that we do in Muharram, people tend to sometimes think these are cultural phenomenon. We want to see, where do we get this culture of keeping Ashura alive from within the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam. But let me begin first with who Hussein is. Now, I'm sure all of us, including these young men in the front, they probably know Imam Hussein, right? They know who his father is. Who is the father? Imam Ali. Who is the mother? Fatima. So they know the mother and the father. I'm sure they know when he was born. Okay. They might know when he's born, but they may have forgotten it right now because I put them on the spot. But I'm sure they know a lot of the specifics about Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and we all do, because we attended the majalis when we talk about his wiladat in Sha'aban, and we obviously gather in Muharram to commemorate his martyrdom. I want to share with us just one beautiful tradition from the Sunni and the Shia sources of the love that Rasulullah had for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And keeping in mind that this was, yes, it was the grandson of the Prophet. He had that biological link, that blood relationship. But obviously it goes much deeper than just a grandfather and grandson relationship. You know, many of us who have grandchildren, obviously we love them because they are an offshoot of us. They come from our daughter, they come from our son. And so we have that affinity to them. But Rasulullah, his love for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, was something which transcended a blood relationship. And this is clear when Allah would refer to Hussein and Hassan alayhim wassalam as the sons of Rasulullah. When in the event of Mubahala, they were told to come and be a representation of the children of the Messenger of Allah. So the story goes like this, to show us the love of Imam Hussein that the Prophet had. Is one day, Rasulullah is invited to a lunch in the city of Medina. So him and a group of the Sahaba, the companions, they're walking to whoever that person's house was where they're having the lunch party. And as they're walking down the streets of Medina, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was a young boy. He couldn't have been more than 6, 7, 8 years old maximum when this event happened. So Imam Hussein is also walking in the same alleyways. And Rasulullah with his companions, he sees Imam Hussein. And as the Rasulullah goes to run to grab Imam Hussein, the little boy, I mean I call him Imam, but he's an 8-year-old boy, a 7-year-old boy. He runs away from the Prophet, playing a game with Rasulullah as a young child would do. The Prophet would run in another direction. Imam Hussein would run away from the Prophet again, playing this like hide and go seek that we I'm sure play with our own children. This happened a few times. Imam Hussein is running back and forth. The Prophet lovingly tries to grab him. He evades the Prophet. And then finally the Prophet gets a hold of Imam Hussein. He hugs him. He puts his hand on his back, one hand on his chest. And the hadith says that the Prophet is doing this. The companions are looking at Rasulullah like, what are you doing? You know, this is something maybe unheard of for them to treat a child with such love. He grabs Imam Hussein, he kisses him. And then Imam, the Prophet, says that beautiful statement where he says, Husseinu minni wa ana min Hussein. Ahabballahu man ahabba Husseinan. That Hussein is from me and I am from Hussein. May Allah love that person who loves Hussein. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And this is just one example that we have in the stories and in the hadith of the Muslims, of all of the Muslims, because no Muslim today can stand and say that they hate the Ahlul Bayt. It is a part of Iman from all Muslims to love the Ahlul Bayt. And all Muslims have these sorts of anecdotes in the life of Sayyidul Shuhada. And we've heard the stories, I've talked about it in the past, when Rasulullah would be in Sajda, and sometimes Imam Hassan or Hussein would climb on the back of the Prophet. And they would play on the back of the Prophet for such a long period of time. The Sahaba praying behind the Prophet would have thought, as when they finished the Salat, they would say that, Ya Rasulullah, did revelation come to you? You're in Sajda for 2, 3 minutes, whatever the time was. And he would say, no, wahi, revelation did not come to me. But one of my grandchildren was playing on top of my back. And I didn't want to get up and hurt the child. He would fall off. So I waited until he came off my back. There are stories when Rasulullah would be on the minbar like this in Masjid al-Nabawi. He would be giving a sermon to the companions. Imam Hassan and Hussein would run into the hall. And he would actually get off of the mimbar, sit with them, put them on his lap, and play with them and caress them. And then they would go back and play because they were children at the end of the day. And Rasulullah would again ascend the mimbar and continue in his discourse. And there are so many traditions like this of Sayyidul Shuhada that the Muslims at that time, when they saw the way that the messenger interacted with his grandchildren, the way he played with them, the love he showed for them, the concern that he had for them, that there are so many traditions that talk about this love and affection the Prophet had. And obviously we know that in the ayat of the Quran, many times Allah would reveal verses in praise of the Ahlul Bayt. We know that Ayat of Tathir, chapter 33, verse 33. We know Surah Al-Insan, chapter 76. The entire chapter is about the Ahlul Bayt. We know many other ayat that came about the Ahlul Bayt and about Sayyidul Shuhada also in a general nature. So the summary and the gist of this is that Muslims at the time of Rasulullah, they loved, they respected, they cherished Sayyidah Shabab Ahlul Jannah. They loved Imam Hassan and Hussein alayhim wassalam. They would also show affection to these grandchildren. And this actually continued. When you look at the books of history, during the time of the first three Khulafa, because of the status of Sayyidul Shuhada and his brother Imam Hassan alayhim wassalam, peace be upon both of them, the general community and even the Khulafa treated these two grandchildren with the utmost of respect. To the point where even non-Shia historians narrate an incident that one day during the reign of the second caliph, he's on the mimbar giving a lecture and Imam Hussein sits at the foot of the mimbar and he addresses the second khalifa and he says that I want you to get off of my mimbar of the member of my grandfather, rather, and go on to your father or your grandfather's member. And the second Khalifa, what can he say? He says, my grandfather doesn't have a member for me to sit on. Imam Hussein alayhi salam was making a point as a young man that authority that man had, he may have been the Khalifa in terms of the outward political authority, but he was showing that he didn't have the legislation or the legitimate authority to be on that member. So he proved it through this example. But nonetheless, he was treated with respect. People would not dare speak against, say, the Shuhada. They would love him, treat him with respect, give him the honor that he deserved as the grandson of Rasulullah. Again, that continued for the first, the second, the third Khalifa. And once the third Khalifa was killed and Amir al-Mu'mineen takes over the caliphate, he now is elected, we can say, to become the leader of the Muslims, although we know he was leader from the day Rasulullah leaves this world. But when Amir al-Mu'mineen takes on the Khilafat, he moves the base from Medina to Kufa. We know that the entire Ahlul Bayt, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein alayhim wassalam, Lady Zainab, her family, they all pick up and move to Kufa as well. And so in the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, he wasn't silent. Historical references don't give us maybe a day-by-day or year-by-year analysis of what Imam Hussein was doing in the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen's Khilafat. But we do know that in that 4 years and 9 months or so, or 5 years that Imam Ali had this open caliphate, that he fought three major battles within the Muslim Ummah. This civil war that erupted amongst the community. And we're told in every one of those battles, him and his brother Imam Hassan alayhi wasalam, that they both had prominent roles to play in the different aspects of the military, guiding and leading the military forces on the side of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Eventually, as we know, Amir al-Mu'mineen is martyred in the Masjid of Kufa, and we know that the family ends up moving back to Medina. There are issues that come up with Imam Hassan alayhi salam, with what he has to deal with the likes of Muawiyah. But even in that time, we see that Sayyidah Shuhada is close with Imam Hassan. And obviously he has to be, because yes, it's his older brother. But keep in mind, it's also his imam. Yes, Sayyidah Shuhada would become the imam later on, but at that time, he is following his imam of his time. And so whatever Imam Hassan alayhi salam would ask him to do, would command him to do, would be at the level of the imam. He was the authority, the proof, the hujjat of Allah upon the earth. And so Sayyidah Shuhada continues in this method of working with his brother, of helping and supporting him in whatever way he needs, until obviously his own brother is martyred and the imamah now transfers over to Sayyidah Shuhada, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. And obviously from there, as we say that the rest is history, we know that after he takes over the imamate, that the political turmoil after Muawiyah loses his life, he appoints his son, which was against the peace treaty that they had signed, and against all that what had been agreed upon between Imam Hassan and Muawiyah. We realize that at that point is where the event of Karbala comes into play. And again, you've been present in the majalis in Muharram. I don't want to repeat what was said over those 10 or 11 or 12 nights. But we know that Sayyidah Shuhada, he launched that revolution. He was successful, even though from the apparent aspect, people say he wasn't victorious. We realize that victory came in another way for Sayyidah Shuhada. But tonight what I want to do is, for the brief time that I have, and I don't want to go over time, I want to look briefly at what the Imams of Ahlul Bayt did to preserve the legacy of Karbala. Right? Because sometimes as a community, young and old, we sometimes question that what are we doing in Muharram? Right? We gather, we decorate, or we cover our centers in black. We ourselves are wearing black. We sit for 10, 11, 12 nights. We lament, we cry, we beat our chests. We do all of these actions. But do any of these actually have a religious basis? You know, many young men and women, I'm sure, growing up, we're given to understand that this is a cultural phenomenon, that our parents from the Middle East or from East Asia or from whatever part of the world they came from, maybe they thought that we brought this over as a tradition, as a cultural phenomenon, as a cultural experience of expressing our grief over Karbala. But tonight I want to look at just three aspects of what we perform in Muharram to show us that what we do as a community, it has a direct basis in the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And it's important for you and I to always go back to the source. Go back to the Quran. Go back to the Ahlul Bayt. And we have to remember that that hadith, when Rasulullah said the hadith of Thaqalain, to follow both of them and we would never go astray. That when we come to the event of Karbala and we want to see, well, how should we commemorate it? We have to go back. Either the Quran talks about some of these issues or alludes to some of the concepts. And if not the Quran, then definitely we need to go to the Ahlul Bayt and see what have they instructed us, or have they instructed us even, to commemorate and to keep alive this legacy and this memory of Karbala. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. One of the first things that we see within our communities, and this has been a tradition for not just 10 or 20 years, but 1,000 or so odd years, is that we gather together in these sessions, what we call the Majalis of Hussein. A majlis literally is a place to sit, right? It doesn't have a sanctity to itself, that word. But the concept is what is important. And the concept was, and this came, you know, this was even pre-Islam, or, you know, even it's a human concept to sit and talk and discuss things in a gathering. People who are not Muslims have majalis. They have gatherings where they'll sit and they'll talk. It might be about good things or bad. It may be about religion or politics. They have a majlis though. And so what we have to understand is that when this event of Karbala transpired, one of the ways that the Ahlul Bayt used to ensure that we don't forget what happened and that we remember the lessons that we have to implement in our lives is they began to establish these sessions of mourning. Sessions where people would recount the tragedy of Karbala, where people would be brought in from outside sometimes. Poets would be brought in from within the community. Speakers would be brought in from amongst the Shias of Ahlul Bayt. And they would be asked to sit and talk and relate the event of Karbala. Now obviously we have to keep in mind that our gatherings today in 2016, they are probably vastly different than what happened 1,000 years ago. You know, the area, the atmosphere, everything about our gatherings is unique. There are some aspects which would be carried over from that day. But otherwise, it is a unique event that is, you know, molded according to our own culture and where we live today. But the general premise of a majlis, of a sitting, of a gathering, to remember what happened to Ahlul Bayt, this goes back to, we can say, even the time of Lady Zainab alayhi salam and Imam Zainul Abideen alayhi salam, when they began to speak and, you know, relate the tragedy. But when we look at it at an official, if you want to look at it at a institutionalized level, we have hadith from the fourth imam, but we also have a hadith which I wanted to share from our fifth imam, in which the hadith mentions that, and this is coming from what the imam used to do, the hadith says that the fifth imam, he would have a gathering in which he would cry over what happened to Imam Hussein. And he would cry and lament, and then he would ask all of the people who live with him at home not to observe taqiyah, not to hide that this is a majlis of sorrow, of grief, and that they would sit and lament and cry, remembering what happened in Karbala. And then he had said, the hadith says that he would also encourage the people who lived with him to offer condolences to one another over the tragedy of Karbala. So the fifth imam is showing us that, and there's multiple hadith, not just this one. We have again from the fourth imam, from the fifth imam, the eighth imam talks about it, how there would be majalis. And in fact, in the eighth imam's hadith, we're told that he would have men and women come over to his house, and then he would have a curtain put between the men and the women. So even the wall, the partition that we have is not culture. We're not scared of mixing with the ladies or the ladies with the men. But the imam show us when they had a majlis, they would actually put a physical partition between the genders, and then they would have the majlis. So a lot of this is not, none of this rather I could even say is culture. This is from the imams. And we can't say it's Arab culture because the imams embody, yes, they were Arabs by birth, but their culture was not necessarily Arab culture per se. They're teaching us also lessons in how to formulate our gatherings and our majalis. And obviously in our own day and age, in the 21st century, these majalis become even a greater extension of us learning about our religion. Just at the time of the imams, those speakers would lament and explain what happened in Karbala. So today we have the same concept, where speakers will come and they'll pick a topic and they will elaborate on that topic for 10, 11, 12 nights, also giving us the narrative of Karbala from the authoritative sources. And so this becomes a continuation of that legacy of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, to have people gather, to learn about the religion, to lament about Karbala, to remember the tragedy and the sorrow and every action, even the matam that we do. The Imams would again call people who are poets and ask them to recite poetry. And there's a beautiful tradition when one time the Imam calls a poet and he asks him to recite poetry about, say, the Shuhada. The man recites the poetry and the Imam stops him halfway. He says, stop. He says, don't recite the poetry like that. He says, recite it in the style that you would recite when you're at the grave of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Because we know even in our country, in our culture, when you recite poetry, it can be like a spoken word style, or it can be with a tune, with a pattern, or with a rhythm. And there are different styles of poetry used to convey different sentiment. And the Imam made it known that when you recite for Imam Hussein, make it in that way that people would lament and actually feel the passion and emotion of what is going, you know, what is being recited in that poem. So number one is that the Imams preserved Karbala through the institution of the majalis, of these gatherings of us sitting and listening and remembering the tragedy of Karbala. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Another thing that we see with the lives of the Imams, of how they try to preserve the legacy of Karbala, is that in almost every action that they would go through, they would try their best to relate that event to the event of Karbala, to keep that memory alive. So it wasn't only remembering it in a majlis, on 10 days or 12 days in the mosque, and then you go home. No, even at home, the Imams stressed on the remembrance of Karbala. So we have that beautiful hadith, which I think is even on the magnets that are being sold, where the Imams of Ahlul Bayt say, O our Shia, whenever you drink cold water, remember Hussein and the thirst of Hussein. So this began to be like a culture at home. When the Ahlul Bayt would be at home, they picked up a glass of water, they would remember Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Say Bismillah, send your salutations on Abu Abdullah. Why? To keep alive that legacy that he was killed thirsty on the day of Ashura. Right? It's not just a habit, okay, say Bismillah and remember Imam Hussein. No, it was to keep alive that legacy. You know, maybe we forget Imam Hussein because after Ashura, after Safar, after 9th of Rabiul Awal, we get into our own routine, our centers, the cloth is removed. We put our black shirt in the closet for next Muharram. We tend to forget Abu Abdullah sometimes. Maybe we do. I don't know, I do. Maybe you guys don't. But Imams of Ahlul Bayt showed us that, you know what, when you drink water, remember Karbala. When you eat food, remember that Imam Hussein had nothing for so many days. We know that the fourth Imam, whenever food would be placed in front of him, we're told that he would cry so much, not only would his beard be drenched in his tears, but the pot where the food was in, it would be full of tears of the fourth Imam. And he would remember how his father was slaughtered like an animal, like a sheep was slaughtered. So this became a part of everyday culture and life of the Imams. Again, for us to also realize that Karbala should always be in our memory, not just the tragedy of it, but also what lessons we learn that we can implement in a day-to-day life. Let me share with you a story that happens at the time of the sixth Imam. With Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, one of the Abbasid Khalifas, Mansur al-Dawaniki, one of the evils, obviously, of Bani Abbas. He one day, in a fit of rage, goes to the house of the sixth Imam in Medina, and he lights the door on fire. He lights the house on fire, and probably hoping to either scare the Imam or maybe even burn and kill the Imam. But what happens is the Imam is at home. The women and the children are also at home, his family. The women and children began to scream because the house is on fire, the door is on fire. They're running from here to there through the patio, going into one room to the other. And what ends up happening is the fire is eventually put out. The 60 mom goes, he puts the fire out. A day later, some of his Shias come to the house. They come to the house of the 60 mom and they say, we're here to just see, are you okay? Do you need anything? You know, we know what happened yesterday. Can we do anything for you? Do you need any support? And they see the imam is crying profusely. He's shedding tears. And these companions, they're wondering, well, what happened to the imam? Is he really that worried about a door burning down? Was he really that frightened about his house being lost? And he asked them to sit down and he tells the companions, he says that when my door was on fire and I saw my ladies and my children running from the courtyard to the house, from room to room, from here to there, he says, I sat and I put the fire out. He goes, but I thought for a minute, what would have been the state of my grandfather, Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, when he was being martyred in Karbala, and that the family would have been going through that challenge of the tents being put on fire, and the ladies running from room to room, from tent to tent. He says, at least me, the 60 imam, I was here at home to be a guardian for the women and children. But my grandfather was no longer alive to safeguard the women and the children. And so he showed that such an incident, just the house or a door being burnt, but that brought such a level of emotion to him that it immediately drew his attention to Karbala and what his forefathers would have been facing, what the ladies and the women and children had gone through on that day of Ashura. And so it shows us again at that level of when we remember these events, and this is again not just the 60 imam telling us a story, right? It's a beautiful, powerful, moving story that the imam would have that sort of, that legacy carried on from his forefathers. But it shows us as well that when we look at our own lives, that we need to ensure that we are treating those people in our life just as Abu Abdullah alayhi salam would want, well, he would have treated his family. You know, sometimes we see within our communities issues of spousal abuse, of child abuse, of many issues that happen in our community, in our society. And if we remember what happened to the women and children in Karbala, then we would not want that to happen to our own ladies. If we have that picture of the enemy forces slapping the women in Karbala on their face and ripping their hijabs and ripping the earrings off, and then a man would have the audacity to abuse his wife, or a wife to abuse the husband, or for a parent to slap their child, that picture of what happened to Sakina alayhi salam should be enough for us to realize that what we hear in the narrative is not just about lamenting that day. It's for us to internalize and say that I never want to be what those evil people were on the day of Ashura. That they did evil, I'm not going to be the same to my women and my children and my family. I'm going to be different than they are. And so when the Ahlul Bayt, when they gave us these anecdotes, it wasn't just to lament, it was for us to realize, to change our own character. Salwa ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. And last but not least for tonight, we'll end with this. One of the traditions of Ahlul Bayt, one of the things that they've taught us through Karbala, the legacy that they have retained to keep this legacy alive, is to cry and make others cry. You know, today at Jummah we talked about the emotional aspect of the human being. I don't want to repeat that. But emotions are a very important part of our culture, of our being human beings. Forget about our culture. Emotions play a tremendous role in us as human beings. The example which I gave, is, for example, when an earthquake hits a country, or a hurricane strikes, as it has last week in the Caribbean islands. And even if we were just to hear that a Category 4 hurricane hit a particular island, and buildings were destroyed, and infrastructure was demolished, and we heard 200 kilometer winds, we wouldn't be really moved to have emotions over hearing those facts and figures. We wouldn't be moved to want to give our time, our effort, our money to help those people. But if we watched the internet, we saw the news, and we saw pictures of children under the rubble, if we saw people who had lost everything and an earthquake, that picture would stir an emotion in us, wouldn't it? If we just heard a tornado, okay, well, a tornado, but we don't relate it to a human being. But when we see and hear the graphic nature of Karbala, that begins to stir our emotions. And when we stir the emotion, then we begin to relate at one level, at a minimal, of what happened on that day. And when we relate to it, we have no choice but to cry and to make others cry. And so when the imams would speak about how to preserve the emotional aspect of Karbala, what they would tell us in the hadith, and it's beautiful, they say that a person who cries over hearing of what happened to Imam Hussein, or no, you don't, you yourself are not only crying, but you make other people cry. You're a speaker, you're one who writes poetry, you somehow make somebody cry about Karbala. And not even that, the Imam says, if you do those two, they say, okay, you have Jannah, paradise is incumbent on you. But the Imam says, if you can't cry, you can't make other people cry, but you pretend to cry, maybe the tears don't come. You know, you can't feel it that impactful in your life, but you pretend that you're crying, that you show that sorrowness in your heart, maybe the tears don't come out. He says, even if you pretend that you're showing sorrow, you're pretending to cry, but having that grief, they say even for that person, Jannah is incumbent on that individual. So it's not about showing off. Don't get me wrong, think, oh, you just show off the tears. No, it's that you are feeling the emotion of what happened in Karbala. You're feeling of every stage of what happened, not only the killing of the men, but you feel the tragedy of the women and the attacks that they faced. You feel the sorrow of being taken from Karbala to Kufa to Sham. You know, a trip that many of, I'm sure, you have done from Najaf to Karbala, many people have walked. But you have a shortcut you can take. You have water, you have food, you have people who massage your feet. You have all the amenities. But imagine women and children who have just seen their entire family slaughtered, having to walk that opposite route. And without the food, without the water, without the comforts that we would enjoy if we go on that journey. And so the Imams of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam were very clear that crying is an integral part of Karbala, and that they ensured that they gave us what rewards are there for those who had shed even one tear the size of the wing of a fly in relation to Abu Abdullah alayhi salam. Let me end with just one or two words of the musibat of Abu Abdullah and his family, because these are the days and nights of mourning over Karbala and remembering the tragedy of Abu Abdullah and the family of Hussein. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. We know that after Karbala, after the Shuhada had their heads decapitated, that was not the end of the tragedy. As we mentioned even last night, that journey over the blood-stained plains of Karbala continued for the ladies. It continued for Imam Zain al-Abidin, who had already been suffering so much from the fever. Eventually, after many hours, if not over a day and a half, they arrived in the city of Kufa. In addition to the heads being paraded in front of them, they were forced to go to Ubaydah ibn Ziyad to see him and to speak to him in the presence of the cursed Khalifa and his representative. Eventually, after many days in the city of Kufa, that same city where one day the Ahlul Bayt had been the princes and the kings, where they had been teaching Quran to the people, where they had been educating people on the deen of Islam, the call was given that the caravan had to now proceed from Kufa to Sham. And what a terrible journey that will be, brothers and sisters, from Kufa to Sham. We're told that the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that it was put onto a spear, and it was at the very front of this caravan. We're told that as the women and children were put onto the camels, onto the animals to go towards Sham, that the fourth Imam had been given special treatment by the government of the time, whereas the other people were chained. But we're told that the fourth Imam had a unique way that he had been chained. They say that he had shackles around both of his ankles with a chain between them. We're told that he had shackles on his arms with a chain between those. But it wasn't enough that they also had a shackle around the neck of the fourth Imam. But brothers and sisters, the historians tell us the shackle was quite unique. Whereas usually you'd think that if there were spikes, the spikes would point outwards. But we're told this iron shackle had spikes pointing inwards into the neck of the Imam. So every time the Imam would walk, the spikes would poke deeper and deeper into the neck of the Imam. as the heat of the day would get hotter and hotter, the iron shackles on the imam would become harder and harder, and they would sever the skin on the legs and the arm and the neck of the imam. And we can only think and hear of the tragedies of the fourth imam as they had to continue the entire journey all the way from Kufa, all the way to Sham in such a terrible state, to eventually come face to face with the cursed Yazid and to have to be in front of him in such a state after losing so many loved ones on the day of Ashura. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّ لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّ إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. We ask you, Ya Allah, بِحَقِّ مُحَمَّدْ وَأَلِيهِ Wa Fatima, wa Hassan, wa Hussein, that you accept this act of worship from us tonight. We ask you, Ya Allah, to keep us amongst the helpers and the assistants of our Imam when he makes his advent. We ask you, Ya Allah, to hasten the zuhur of our Imam and to allow us to be amongst his adherents and his supporters. Rabbana taqabbal minna innaka anta as-sami'.